Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm playing the second half of the interview I did with centenarian Norman Cousins. There's more of the extraordinary life of this extraordinary man who, as he said, his career was a series of accidents, but accidents based on the most amazing talent and commitment to honesty and civility and, in every way, the best of American ideals. Listen to him tell about the program he wrote for the end of World War II to celebrate the surrender of Germany, called On a Note of Triumph, which, after it aired, was critiqued by Billboard magazine as the best program ever. This is an amazing, one-of-a-kind human being. And listening to his passion and his commitment that you can still hear in the shaky quality of the 100-year-old voice is really something special. So hang on. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down from nowhere, sitting in my own soft lap, with all the time for us to chat, and my resources all on tap. Oh,
and welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is all about being who you really are. That is, demonstrating, acting, being, not the person you came to believe you should be, or had to be, or that other people wanted you to be, or that other people were, but the person you really are. I say quite often that it must seem odd for me to say this, because some people say, well, who can I be other than who I really am? But actually, we're so flexible, we human beings. We have such skill at dissembling, at what the politicians call spinning. Early on, we get a very good idea of the person that's going to work in our system, and we become that person. And what that generally means is that to some extent we are hiding, denying parts of ourselves. And because that takes so much energy to do, after a while we just forget that we're doing it. We forgot that we did it. And we think that these things that we have hidden about ourselves actually don't exist. And so we demonstrate a person who is only part of what we really are. So in this show, I want to talk about that. I want to encourage everybody to think about things that they might be hiding, ways in which they might be different if they let themselves out. In addition, I do an interview series called Anatomy of an Artist, in which I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And as I say every week, I do this because we make it so difficult for people to do artistic things with their life in this culture, that in order to do it, it really has to be who you actually are. And when you listen to the interviews with the people who have made a living or and life with an art, you can hear that they are exactly who they are, at least in the area of their work. Today, I am playing the second part of an interview I did with centenarian Norman Corwin, who will be 101 in May of this year, 2011. This interview picks up where Norman is talking about his production, his writing of and producing on the radio of We Hold These Truths, which was a celebration of the signing of the Bill of Rights, 150th anniversary of the signing of the Bill of Rights, which happened ironically on December 7th, 1941, which is of course the day that Pearl Harbor was bombed and the beginning of our entry into World War II. And he's talking about Orson Welles. After the interview, I'm going to play as much as I can get into this show of another of Norman's extraordinary work, also narrated by Orson Welles, called Between Americans. I'm going to play as much of it as I can. If you go to my website, you can hear the entire thing. You can also hear, if you were listening last week to the interview, the beginning of the interview with Norman, you heard him say that the very first thing he wrote for radio, the very first play he wrote for radio, was The Plot to Overthrow Christmas, which you can also hear. It's delightful, and it is what caused Edward R. Murrow to come see him and begin a partnership for the length of Murrow's life. So you can hear part of Between Americans here and the rest of it, if you like, on my website. In 1945, in August, at the end of the war, Norman wrote a piece called On a Note of Triumph, which you will hear him talk about here. And 60 million people tuned in to listen to that performance. I don't even know what to say about Norman Corwin. As far as I can tell, the history of the United States from the 30s until very recently was written and produced by Norman Corwin. If you want to know what was going on in the United States, especially during World War II, you just have to Google Norman Corwin. He was completely on top of it. And you hear at the end of this that he finally had to leave CBS, where he had been for, I don't know, since the 30s, because it became impossible for liberals to remain there. You will also hear him say that he did a piece for the Democratic National Committee, but didn't say that it was his because he was afraid to be known as a Democrat. Remember that he lived in and worked during the McCarthy years, the House on Un-American Activities Committee. Norman Corwin was always a patriot, always a courageous commentator on what he saw to be right and good. This part of the interview picks up with Norman talking about the fact that Orson Welles narrated his radio play called We Hold These Truths, which he wrote as a celebration of the 150th anniversary of the Bill of Rights. As with all of Norman's pieces, this is an extraordinary piece of writing in which he used many of the most well-known actors of the time. I'm going to broadcast that entire piece for the show that I do, which is closest to July 4th. And that would be Tuesday, July 5th. So I'm going to broadcast that in its entirety for my July 5th show. And I hope that you will listen. It's an extraordinary piece of writing. And so I don't want to say any more about that. So I'm going to stop talking now and play the second part of my interview with Norman. And following that is going to be a piece of Between Americans. This was broadcast, ironically, on December 7th, 1941, which you might remember is the day on which Pearl Harbor was bombed and also signaled the beginning of our involvement in World War II. So now here, Norman Corwin.
So Orson Welles was in a program on the Bill of Rights, the 150th anniversary of the Bill of Rights, the ratification of the Bill of Rights. Mm-hmm. And later I was around to repeat that show 50 years later. Oh, yeah. For the 200th anniversary. That one, that production was for NPR.
Ah, yes.
Yeah.
Ah. Chris is showing me a photograph of Charles Lawton and saying that you introduced him to American poetry. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Is he a snob about British poetry?
No, just ignorant.
Ah. So what did you introduce him to? Who did you introduce him to?
Thomas Wolfe.
Ah.
And Whitman and Sandburg. He was delighted to meet them, even in print, and became a very good friend and met me when I came to California and put me up for 3 months.
What brought you to California?
The movies.
How did that happen?
I was through at CBS, and I there was a job at RKO that Lawton, when he got back, I met Lawton in New York, Charles Lawton,
mm-hmm.
and worked with him on a program called Pursuit of Happiness, which was emceed by Burgess Meredith.
Uh-huh.
And it was a good superior program of Americana.
Mm-hmm.
And when Lawton, who was delighted with Whitman and Sandberg and said to me, when you come to California, you're going to stay with us. And that's what happened. I went to California and I was met at Burbank, which was the airport. And I was met by Lawton and his wife, Elsa, and driven around California, and they including Farmer's Market. And it was a happy occasion.
So how did you get into the movies?
Through Lawton, who promoted me as a writer, and I came out and wrote an RKO picture, which was never made, but it was my first Hollywood assignment.
You did the screenplay for Lust for Life.
Yeah. The Vincent Van Gogh picture. Kirk Douglas played Van Gogh, and very well. Minnelli, who directed it, thought it was his best work, which pleased me no end, because he was a great director.
Mm-hmm. So you went from you went from the radio writer for newspaper to the poetry guy to the interviewer of the ash can roller, right?
That's right.
To a director writer at CBS.
Yeah.
Right? To making history with Edward R. Murrow and Orson Welles, and then to Hollywood.
And Lawton appeared in many of my programs. And I did a program of the work of Thomas Wolfe. Mm. And Lawton...
You Can't Go Home Again? Is that Thomas Wolfe?
That was one of the sources. Mm-hmm. And it was after the death of Wolfe, who died a young man. I was asked to do a program for the Democratic National Committee on election eve. For FDR was running against the Attorney General of New York, Dewey. But I contributed my services to the Democratic National Committee, and I said I didn't want to be paid. I was very pure about that, because I had just joined CBS, and for me to declare myself as a Democrat was a risky business, so I didn't take credit for that program.
Why was it a risky business?
Why?
Why was it risky to declare yourself as a Democrat at CBS?
I didn't know that I would have been safe, but I took no chances. I had just joined CBS as a as a director
right.
of programs. I didn't even know I could write them.
Well, apparently you didn't know yourself you could write them.
I didn't know myself. And I could write. And I did write.
Yes, and you've written ever since, apparently.
Yeah.
Are you, you said you were writer in residence at UCLA. Are you, what are you writing now?
I'm still a writer in residence.
USC.
I'm playing
oh, it's USC, sorry.
I'm playing hockey from that job right now.
So, of all of the things that you've done, and you've done so many things, my God, which is your favorite thing? What made you the happiest?
An interview I with you.
Oh, don't do that. Tell me the truth.
A program at the end of the war in Europe, which Millwood came out the next day and said, this is the greatest program ever.
Who said this?
Billboard. Billboard magazine.
Oh, Billboard.
Yeah.
Yes. Ah.
And it didn't do me any harm.
No. No. No.
I noticed like that. And it's, the program was okay.
What was it?
Program of the year on the surrender of Germany called On an Order of Triumph.
On an Order of Triumph.
On a Note of Triumph.
On a Note of Triumph.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And it had a wonderful narrator who had a quality like Orson Welles. Named Martin Gable.
Ah, I know Martin Gable. He appeared on TV quiz shows
yes.
in like the 60s
right.
or something, right?
But he was smarter than even Orson. And the same kind of voice as
yes.
Orson. But much more aware of the world and its problems than Orson, although he never did anything to top the War of the Worlds, which is carried by every station. The War of the Worlds. The Mars program.
Yes, I know. I know of it. Yes.
Was a great triumph for Orson.
Yes. But he didn't have the kind of career you had, which just goes on and on and on, right?
For one thing, he died young.
Well.
He died young and fat.
He did. Well, by comparison to you, everybody's dying young, you know. And you're not fat either.
I gained weight.
Well, you don't get around that much, huh?
I don't get around at all. I'm confined to a wheelchair.
Yeah, yeah. So, I ask people who have made a living or a life with an art, and you have made an extraordinary life of essentially the art of the word, you know?
Yes.
Pretty much everything you've done has been based in the word.
That's right.
Yeah. So, what is that like?
I love the language.
Yes.
It's a wonderful language, and it's enjoying the primacy as it deserves. English is a world language, and this is accepted as the official language of aviation. All airport pilot conversations are in English.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah.
And I would guess that you have done pretty much as anyone has to put the language in front of people in every form.
Thank you.
You know? No.
I've been lucky that I was lucky that I introduced that Russian dialect character on the Swan River.
That wasn't luck. That was talent. That was smart. That was why it worked. Because it wasn't luck. It was none of it luck.
Yeah.
But we are so grateful to you for all of it, for all of how you have honored the language, you know?
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Norman Corwin. This has been extraordinary. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
No, mine.
As you can hear, I thought this was the end of the interview, but then Chris, who is Norman Corwin's helper, brought up another piece of information that they wanted me to have and I wanted to have. So I put the tape recorder back on and we got this.
And the publisher of the Herald Tribune.
A wonderful woman called me one day and said, can I come over to see you? And in deference to her, I said, you can, but don't you want me to come to see you? And she said, no, I will come to see you. And she came and offered me the keynote of the Herald Tribune, they had a program every year that was opened by the then President of the United States in the Waldorf Astoria, and she asked me to write this year's keynote speech on the responsibilities of victory. This is 1945, when the war ended. And I wrote it, and she said, when she's finished her interview with me, who can we get to do it? And I seized on the opening and I said, well, a black, she said, great idea. How is Robeson? And I said, that's a splendid idea. Where is he? She asked. I called Celebrity Service and they said, Robeson is in Toronto in a play. And I then and there called the theater to speak to Robeson to tell him what I had discussed. And what did he do it? And he said, send me the script. And I did. I wrote the script It was published in the Herald Tribune.
I don't want to make you any more tired. So, are you working on anything now? Are you thinking about anything? Any project?
I'm blind in one eye.
Uh-huh.
I'm blind in this eye.
Yeah.
And I have a cancer in that eye.
Oi.
And that blinds it. And I have to have a liver scan every now and then to make sure the cancer is not reaching my liver. I'm sorry to introduce the ugly facts.
You don't have to apologize for anything. Ever.
Well, thank you. Thank you. You are very kind.
I am not. You are very kind. This is an amazing thing to do. I mean, it seems to me that you have spent your entire life giving, you know, of your mind, of your talent, of your brains, of your heart, you know, and you just keep doing it.
Well, I was lucky to be able to do it, and to have I was lucky to be employed by CBS instead of NBC, because NBC had a policy that they would cut a program in the middle of a sentence if it ran over. No such nonsense at CBS.
Really? Wow. You were lucky.
Yeah, and CBS let me alone and gave me great assignments.
Which you did wonderfully.
Which I did with distinction.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
At least I think I can say that.
So they continued to give them to you. It makes perfect sense to me.
And I finally left them when it became too uncomfortable for liberals. First liberal to go was Ed Morrow.
Wow.
And then myself. And I came out here.
Wow.
At the invitation of Lawton.
And made an entire new career for yourself. Right?
What?
And made an entirely new career for yourself.
Yes.
You just kept reinventing yourself. Isn't it true?
It's true.
Yes. You're a role model.
It's true.
I know. Okay. Oh, Mr. Corwin, thank you so much.
You're welcome. I would like to see what you do with that.
I definitely will send you a copy of it.
Thank you.
You are welcome.
So there you have centenarian Norman Corwin. And I'm glad to be able to be playing a part of Between Americans. It's a remarkably moving piece, as is We Hold These Truths, which I'll be playing on my July 4th, well, you know, 5th show. But this is narrated by Orson Welles. It's just amazing, and I'm sorry I can't play it all, but never mind. I'm just going to play what I can play of it now.
Between Americans, starring Orson Welles. The Gulf Screen Guild Theater. The Gulf Oil Companies and your good Gulf dealer are proud to present a dramatic picture of this, our America. Here is your host, Roger Pryor, to tell you about it.
Good evening, everyone. We welcome you tonight to one of the most timely programs ever heard on the Gulf Screen Guild Theater. Our production of Norman Corwin's script, Between Americans, starring Orson Welles. Broadcast at any time, we believe this program would make every American's heart beat a little faster. Make him hold his head just a little higher. But since the tragic and foreboding news that came today, this program, Between Americans, now becomes an American odyssey. Now, Oscar Bradley's music introduces Orson Welles, who will talk Between Americans.
This program is Between Americans. That's where the title comes in. We hope you like it, but you don't have to. At any rate, nobody's going to make you stick around and listen to it. That's one of the advantages of being an American. Now, tonight we're doing something quite foreign to the type of thing usually presented by the Gulf Screen Guild Theater. Instead of telling a story about five or six people, we're telling a story about 100 million. This happens to include you, listener, whatever your name may be. As a matter of fact, names don't bother real Americans very much. Not when we've got states named after French kings and English queens are lifted right out of the Latin language like Montana, or out of the Spanish like Nevada, and towns. You know, if you were to hold a convention of all the people who live in foreign-sounding American towns, we could fill quite a sizable stadium. Among the delegates registering on the first day would be...
Me, I'm the delegate from London, Minnesota.
I'm in from Dublin, New Hampshire.
Flew in this morning from Cairo, Illinois.
Huh? Whose turn, me? I'm from Canton, Connecticut.
I'm from Paris, Texas.
I came all the way from Shanghai, West Virginia.
Walsall, Georgia.
I'm the delegate representing Moscow, Kentucky.
My town is Toronto, Kansas.
As for me, Lisbon, Maine.
Delegate from Madrid, Alabama reporting.
I'm from Stockholm, South Dakota.
Drove down this afternoon from Bombay, New York.
Hitchhiked here from Baghdad, Florida.
All right, delegates, now that you've registered, you may all be seated. Now, that's all the preliminaries there's going to be tonight. We're through with the introductions, the overture, and the official registration. So now we can get down to the text, which is, roughly speaking, this. Today, particularly, people are thinking about their country pretty hard. Some of them for the first time in their lives. People are wondering where we're headed. Men are being called on to get ready to defend America. A lot of them are thinking in terms of what is there to defend. Well, now, America means a lot of things to a lot of people. Most of them are solid patriots, only they don't know it. They don't have to wear a red and white and blue button in their lapels to prove it. They don't have to agree with or even listen to people like this.
My fellow citizens! In this great state of Flint and Petro, we can pick the dog squirtle your taxes. Our great country is cribbly bolted up and can wackle tablewick, and your Langanoy rillera herring done forever.
We got a good hunch most people prefer the quiet kind of speaker, like the fellow who got up on a platform in a Pennsylvania town one day and said,
"The world will little note nor long remember what we say here."
That was the Gettysburg Address he was referring to. As a matter of fact, he didn't get such good reviews the next morning. Take, for example, the write-up he got in the Harrisburg Patriot.
We pass over the silly remarks of the president. For the credit of the nation, we are willing that they shall no more be repeated and thought of.
If you think that's bad, listen to what the Chicago Times had to say.
The cheek of every American must tingle with shame as he reads the silly, flat, and dishwatery utterances of the man who has to be pointed out to intelligent foreigners as the President of the United States.
Of course, the rival paper in Chicago took the opposite point of view. Rival papers often do.
The
remarks of President Lincoln will live among the annals of man.
That paper gave it 4 stars, and they were right. The Gettysburg Address did survive. But that business of calling a president a ham is really something to be proud of. I mean the right to print a piece saying a president makes a sound like dishwater. Nobody dragged the editors off to jail, even if they were wrong. That's important. Comes under the heading of free press. As soon as anybody starts gagging the press, any press, watch out. Americans don't like that. And by the way, we got on earth to be calling ourselves Americans all the time when we're really only United Staters. We're a little selfish about that. It's America down there in Chile, too. All the way down the spine of the Andes. If any of you folks are hearing this down around Mexico or Honduras or Salvador or Argentina, or even if you're an Eskimo in the Arctic, we hope you'll overlook our calling ourselves Americans as though we were the only ones in the hemisphere. We do that just because it's so much easier to say than anything else, and also because it sounds so good. By the way, before we leave the subject, what about the original Americans? The Indians? There's a forgotten race for you. How about the Indian on the nickel and the buffalo who roamed the back of the great American jit? Seems a shame. No two ways about it. We have forgotten those 100% Americans who went down to quarantine to meet the Mayflower. We don't see them around in person very much these days. But their ghosts are still with us. Maybe the red men are forgotten. Maybe not. But between you and us, it's said that near Boonesboro, Kentucky, on certain nights in November, by the light of the waning moon, some very peculiar ghost meetings go on in the woods south of the river. Also in certain parts of the Alleghenies, between the hours of sundown and the coming of the morning mist. Yes, if you happen to be listening to this in a car driving along Highway 99 in Wyoming, that man you passed walking down the road a few miles back wasn't a man at all. Seriously, they were brave people. The Indians fought a losing fight against great odds. Wanted nothing more than to keep their land and their way of life. Fighting the fight so many people of all races have had to fight since. The fight to keep free and independent. The fight to stop men from the outside who want to civilize somebody their way. You ever asked yourself what America means to you? Does it mean 1776? Columbia, the gem of the ocean? Big business? The Bill of Rights? Uncle Sam? Chances are it means none of these things. Chances are it means something very personal to each of you. Something close to your heart which you'd miss like the very blazes if you were stranded abroad. Might have nothing at all to do with quotes from Madison or acts of Congress. It might be just the feeling about the crisp autumns in New England and the smell of burning leaves. It might be the memory of the way they smooth off the infield between the games of a doubleheader. It might be a thing as small as your little finger. Have you ever been abroad and run out of American cigarettes?
Hey, speak English, mister?
No, senor. Solo hablo español.
Well, anyway, do you carry cigarettes?
Ah, cigarrillos. Sí, tenemos bastante aquí.
No, I just want cigarettes. Here, I'll take these. How much?
20 centavos.
Yeah, keep the change. Hey, got a light there, senor?
Sí, como no, senor. Un momento.
Hey, what is this? Soft, cold soup? Tastes like an old shoe. Here, you can smoke the rest of them. Fooey.
There you are. America might mean a tight-packed cigarette, which tastes good. Might mean the way a hot dog man slaps mustard on a Frank. Might mean going with your wife to the movie on bank night. Or taking your girl to the annual barn dance and social at Tuckerman's Barn. Plenty of you listeners know what I'm talking about.
to the grave!
You hear people speak of home defense? This is the home to be defended. The square dance down the glen a piece, an old man Tuckerman's barn. This is the America of all the couples dancing there tonight. That's what the nation means to Butch and Fred and Jenny and Elvira. And this is America to all the boys and girls from Malvern County and their folks at home waiting for them. What do you suppose America means to that auto repair man in the grease cake dungarees who works in the garage in the corner of Willow and Elm Street? It means, quite likely, crawling under the 1936 Buick and dragging an electric light bulb on a long extension after him.
Hey, Joe, hand me that wrench.
What wrench?
The wrench at your feet. I got to finish this apprentice job.
Why don't he sell that jalopy and get a new boat?
Hey, you want to talk us out of business? As long as he keeps his car, we get a repair job once in a while.
Yeah, guess you're right.
Sure. That's America to Pete and Joe. Piston job, transmission job, valve job, jack it up, change the tire. New fan belt, check the pump. On Saturday night, take the girl down to Joyland Dance Park. Means repairs to those boys and cans of oil and carburetor mixtures. And to Jack Prentice, who owns the Buick that Pete is fixing and who lives down on the beach near the Coast Guard station, America means the sound and the sight and the smell of high tide under the full moon. Occasionally the melancholy note of the bellboy drifting up when the wind's blowing in from the ship channel. Means the age-old sound of the sea. The same sound folks are hearing this very minute up around Penobscot Bay and Winthrop Beach and Chincoteague Inlet down by Calabogue Sound and on Boca Chica and then clean over to the other coast by Guadalupe, Carmel. Yes. Wind and wave and sand and rock and riptide and undertow. That's America to Jack Prentice and the hundreds of thousands of folks settled on the coastlines between Eastport and Key West, Point Isabel and Birch Bay. America is all things to all her people. Prairie to Nebraskans, coal to Scranton miners, cameras and raw celluloid to the picture boys in Hollywood. The stink of crude oil to the men who work the wells. Relief checks to the unemployed. A mic and a stopwatch to a radio production man. A BMT express to Brooklyn office workers. Sure, that's the way it goes. Or isn't it? What does this country mean to you? It might mean anything. Anything at all. It might mean a course in highfalutin poetry at Harvard.
Today, gentlemen, we will consider the influence of Whitman on the development of poetry in America. And by 1870, after 12 years of incessant attack against squeamish over-refinements, Whitman really began to create an active distaste for literary effort.
Or else it might be an argument between two baseball fans as to which is the better team, the Yankees or the Red Sox.
Yeah, but look! The Yanks are a bunch of old men and cripples.
Yeah, yeah.
They won't last. I tell you, they won't last. Well, it gets good and hot around the middle of July.
Yes.
Wait, look, doubleheaders begin piling up.
What are you talking? Listen, DiMaggio's having the best season he ever had. He's an old man, huh? Keller hitting a dozen homers. I'd like to be a cripple like that. New home run record for the club. Won't last, huh? Who's the Red Sox got as good as DiMaggio? Name one guy. Name one.
Name two. Ted Williams.
Well, a good hitter. No getting away from that. What you say? Better than DiMaggio?
Attention.
Wait a minute. Do you say...
Or it could be a poker game in Charlie Ferreter's law office upstairs over the 5 and 10 cent store on a rainy afternoon. Or a meeting of the Kiwanis Club in the Mansion House on Thursday. Or the news store. Or a great symphony concert sent out over everybody there, playing the music of all the world's great composers, regardless of their race or nationality. For instance, something by a great German Jew named Mendelssohn. Something you couldn't play in certain countries on the other side. Now let's stop a minute and figure this out. Is it an accident that makes just being a citizen in this comparatively young country so attractive to so many people? To the world's greatest skater from Norway? To the world's greatest mathematician from Germany? To the world's greatest orchestra conductor from Italy? Is it an accident that 1,000,000,000 people all around the world would give everything they own to be in your shoes? A free citizen of this country, right this very minute? Is it the weather here? Let's ask some of the natives. You from New York, how's the weather out your way?
Oh, I like it all right, only the summers give me a pain, sticky and hot. And then we usually get a stretch of terrible overcast weather around April and November. Sometimes 10 days go by without the sun coming out once.
And you, miss, from Miami, Florida.
Oh, our climate's fine. Except you have to watch out for sunburn.
A gentleman from Kansas?
Well, summers get pretty hot. Winter's pretty cold. Tornadoes raise a ruckus every once in a while.
Los Angeles. Hugh.
Ah, wonderful climate. Magnificent.
Don't you ever get tired of all that sunshine?
No, sir. Not a bit.
Never rains?
Well, a little precipitation maybe, but no rain.
No earthquake?
No, just little ones. Are you interested in some real estate?
No, thanks. And you from San Francisco, how about it there?
Best climate in the world, top.
Lots of sunshine?
Lots.
Lots of fog?
Lots.
All right. Then it's not the weather which makes us so attractive. Is it maybe our wine, women, and song? Let's ask the experts. You there, expert on women.
American women are beautiful, certainly. But we've never produced any classic or historic beauty. We've no legendary figure to compare with Helen of Troy, or with any of the Greek or Roman Venuses, or with Egypt's Cleopatra. As far as fiction is concerned, we can offer nobody to stand up against Italy's Juliet, or Germany's Isolde, or France's Roxanne. Certainly not Scarlett O'Hara.
Certainly not.
No, indeed.
All right, that's fine. Thanks very much. Now, what about our wines? Is that what makes America so attractive from the outside looking in? How about it, wine expert?
American wines are excellent, but then, of course, meaning no offense, have you ever heard of French champagne, Burgundy, Libramé?
All right, thank you. Thank you. Can it be our song? Maestro.
America can well be proud of its composers and of its wealth of folk music. But the fact of the matter is that we have yet to produce a single world great symphony, whereas Finland has produced 7, Germany and Austria, 50, the Russians about 12, the French 2 or 3, England 2 or 3, Bohemia...
Not song, then. Neither wine, women, nor song. So what is it, then? Well, it's this. Come right down to it. It's the spectacle of nearly 150 million people trying to live up to the expectations of a handful of great men who lived and died 150 years ago. Men who were so fed up with the kind of government they'd been getting, they sat down and wrote a new constitution for themselves and their children. A democratic constitution that's been added to, but never been topped before or since.
I'm sorry to have to cut this off here, but it's just too long for me to get it all in the show. But as I said, you can go up on my website and hear the entire thing. And if you are interested at all in Norman Corwin's work, tune in on July 5th and hear We Hold These Truths. I'm going to play a tiny piece of the interview with Norman. I'm going to go out on this tiny piece of the interview with Norman, which I took out because it was another one of those false endings, but I just feel compelled to put it on. So it will be the very last thing that you hear in my show. As always, I have to thank Josh Hackney, because without him, there would be no show. He not only comes and fixes the sound as much as it is possible to do after I have done whatever I have done to it, but there's just no technological question I can ask that Josh either doesn't know the answer to or doesn't know how to find, and he is diligent and responsible and kind. So if you need anyone to help you with electronics, recording, computer, any of that, you want Josh Hackney and you want to go up on my website, thelynshow.com, thelynneshow. And I, as I am having to say these days, there is another The Lynn Show spelled the way I spell it. So if you get someone who doesn't seem to be me, it probably isn't. Look again. Okay. As always, I hope that you heard something that you can use today. Something that interested you, compelled you. Something that you were glad to have heard. Something that will bring you back next week. Because, as always, I will be here next week, same time, same station. And boy, I sure hope you will be too.
So I'm wondering, what are your favorite memories?
What?
Your favorite memories.
Talking with you.
I see. You're a charmer. And you always were, right?
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you see my face and figure. I've both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boy. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going. Singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang, so you won't hear me simper. I may have got